content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Steve Lord from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to a half hour of captivating developments in science, medicine, technology, and the world around us, as reported in Discover, the magazine of science. Today's episode from the June and July-August 2018 issues of Discover features four stories on methane and craters, abuse or disease, everything worth knowing about Neanderthals, and everything worth knowing about teeth. Things that go boom, methane and mysterious craters. To the untrained eye, they appear to be meteor impacts, massive funnel-shaped craters about 80 feet across and 15 stories deep that suddenly appear in the Russian tundra. But according to Vladimir Romanovsky, a geophysicist at the University of Alaska who has been monitoring permafrost since the 1970s, nothing like this was described in any scientific or even not scientific literature. We don't even have a good name for it yet, he adds. At last count, at least 9 craters have been confirmed in Yamal, a Russian territory jutting 400 miles north of the Arctic Circle, and neighboring Gaidan. Yamal is home to more reindeer than people, as well as Russia's largest natural gas deposits and the infrastructure to exploit them. The cause of the craters is uncertain. No one has witnessed one form. But researchers have a hypothesis. Ice-like mixtures of methane and water, trapped below and within the permafrost, expand as they warm, heaving up the ground until it erupts. Supporting this explanation, local reindeer herders reportedly heard loud booms soon before craters were first noticed. At the sites, researchers found explosively high methane concentrations and chunks of earth littering the periphery for thousands of feet. Satellite images from previous years showed the craters were once small hills, bulging from the tundra. The fact that they have appeared and weren't really predicted tells me that there are probably surprises out there that we don't know about yet, and I'm sure we'll be seeing soon, says Ted Schur, a permafrost researcher at Northern Arizona University. Although the craters have never been observed before, bulging hills are common in permafrost regions. Systematic surveys using helicopters and satellites counted 7,000 such mounds in Yamal and Gaidan and 1,350 in the Tuktoyaktuk Peninsula of northwest Canada. At that rate, there could easily be 100,000 such potential time bombs across the Arctic. Most are likely due to frost heave, when the water in saturated soil freezes and expands, pushing the ground up. But an unknown number could be methane mounds on the verge of eruption. Eye of the beholder. A boy's mysterious injuries set off alarms at a pediatrics ward. Bobby was an 8-year-old who lived with his family in a small town. His mother, Mary, took him to their family doctor to examine a limp the boy had developed. The doctor suspected a broken bone and referred him to a local emergency room. X-rays showed he had a fractured left shin, which doctors placed in a cast. Bobby was then admitted to our ward at a children's hospital because of concerns about possible child abuse. His mother said he was running and fell on the carpeted living room floor. But most boys don't break their leg from that. Mary seemed concerned about Bobby, but also a bit scattered. It's happened before, but not this bad, she said. When you say it's happened before, what do you mean? I asked. She responded vaguely, saying he had broken at least one bone before this that had required a cast. In his hospital room, I examined Bobby, who appeared short for his age. Other than the fractured shin, he had no bruises or other injuries. But my supervising physician was worried. He popped his head into the room and motioned for me to join him in the hallway. We need to page child protection, he whispered. Most children's hospitals have an in-house version of the service, which examines suspected cases of child abuse and neglect. I notified them. pediatricians are always on the lookout for injuries caused by physical abuse or neglect of a child. Obvious clues are bruises and broken bones that don't quite make sense. Other signs, such as a child being extremely underweight, wearing dirty clothes, or having unkempt hair, can suggest parents aren't tending to their child's basic hygiene and nutritional needs. But it's important not to jump to conclusions. Bobby's medical chart from his hometown doctor was disturbing. He had fractured the same leg when he was 1 year old after falling on a carpeted floor. He had also recently broken his left arm. It's unusual for even the clumsiest child to have several accidents resulting in fractures. Bobby's family doctor was also concerned about his small size and appetite. It wasn't clear whether he was a picky eater or was malnourished due to parental neglect. For children who have limited calcium and vitamin D intake, perhaps from not drinking enough milk, bone formation can be affected, increasing the risk of fracture, and overall growth can be stunted by not receiving the right amount of nutrients. The Child Protection Services, CPS, covering the region where Bobby lived, had been involved with the family since the boy was a month old. Mary was in her early 20s, and Bobby was her second child. She had no income to support the family and hadn't finished high school. About 6 weeks after Bobby's birth, CPS had ordered that she and the children live with Mary's parents. As a pediatrician in training, I had seen several cases that suggested neglect or physical abuse. None of them was clear-cut. In one case, there were concerns of nutritional neglect, but we discovered that the family simply was not educated about healthful foods. But sometimes the opposite is true. One infant with a skull fracture and bruises also had bleeding at the back of his eyes, called retinal hemorrhages, and healed rib fractures. It turned out his parents, both courteous and well-educated, were physically harming the child. When I examined Bobby, the statistics somberly played through my mind. In the United States, almost 700,000 children suffer abuse and neglect each year, with 4/5 of physical abuse inflicted by a parent. Bobby's mother seemed nice enough, but as abuse seemed more likely, I felt moments of anger and sadness rise and release inside me, like fireworks. After the hospital's CPS was contacted, I visited Bobby again in his hospital room. I asked more questions, focusing on the social and family history. I learned that Bobby was in fact a picky eater. He ate a lot of hot dogs and macaroni and didn't drink much milk. But a history of physical abuse wasn't clear. "Is anyone else involved with Bobby's care?" I asked Mary. "No, just me," she said. "I don't work, so we're at home most of the time when he isn't in school." "I don't know what the big deal is," she added. "I had lots of broken bones as a kid." "What do you mean? Did you get injured a lot?" "Yes, I would fall and hurt myself," she said. "I think my bones are just sensitive." The family doctor had told her she had scoliosis, or curvature of the spine, and that one of her legs was longer than the other. I had noticed that Mary waddled, so this would explain it. She was also unusually short. "So Bobby's just like me, right down to our blue eyes. That makes us special, I think," she said. I was confused. Mary's and Bobby's irises were brown. But looking closer, I noticed the whites of their eyes, called the sclera, were a soft baby blue. We took x-rays of Bobby's entire body looking for healed fractures, which confirmed the injuries described in his medical history. The skeletal survey also revealed that Bobby had wormian bones, which appear on the skull as squiggles that look like worms. We performed a bone mineral density of the spine to test how strong his bones were compared with other children his age. His bones were significantly less dense. Bobby essentially had the skeletal strength of a 3-year-old, not an active 8-year-old running and jumping around the house. Our working diagnosis was osteogenesis imperfecta, OI, or brittle bone disease, an extremely rare condition that weakens bones. Bobby had inherited the condition from his mother. He did not have scoliosis, but there can be an association between the conditions, meaning Bobby was at risk of developing scoliosis during his adolescent growth spurts. OI encompasses a range of genetic diseases that result from faulty collagen, a building block for healthy bones. Without it, bones are weak and prone to fracture. Wormian bones are not harmful, but, like short stature, can be signs of the disease. Blue sclera, caused by light reflected off abnormally thin collagen fibers in the eye, can be another telltale sign. We wanted to build up Bobby's bone strength. To do this, we gave him an intravenous bisphosphonate, part of a class of drugs that fight bone loss, and a daily dose of vitamin D. We couldn't change his body's ability to make abnormal collagen, but we could optimize his bone mineralization through this treatment. Bone biopsies every 6 months would chart his progress. We felt confident we had solved the mystery of Bobby's condition. But child abuse can happen to children with OI too, so social workers would continue to monitor the family. I was initially surprised that so many doctors hadn't noticed Bobby and Mary's blue-tinged sclera. But then again, Mary had to tip me off to it. The condition is subtle and hard to notice under the fluorescent lights of a doctor's office. It's a good lesson. Sometimes insight into a diagnosis can arise out of the blue. Everything worth knowing about Neanderthals. Our kissing cousins were close kin. In 1856, quarry workers inadvertently shoveled some bones out of a cave and 65 feet down the steep slopes of Neander Valley, Germany. Salvaged by the quarry owner, the fossils would spark the study of human evolution. The bones were human, but not quite. The limbs were thick, the ribs unusually rounded, and the partial skull had a protruding brow and oblong shape. Some early scholars argued it was a malformed individual, or even a Cossack soldier with rickets. But geologist William King named it Homo neanderthalensis, the first scientifically named fossil hominin, albeit one held in low regard. In 1864, in the Quarterly Journal of Science, King speculated the creature's thoughts and desires never soared beyond those of the brute. Since then, researchers have recovered bones from about 350 Neanderthals, 40,000 to 200,000 years old, from much of Eurasia. New technologies have probed Neanderthal dental plaque and DNA, illuminating their diets, diseases, and genetic code. Neanderthal research is just on fire, says Duke University anthropologist Stephen E. Churchill. Genetic studies have confirmed that Neanderthals were our kissing cousins, evolutionarily speaking. Homo sapiens and Neanderthals descended from the same group of ancestors, likely in Africa, over 520,000 years ago. Some members of this population migrated to Europe, where they evolved into Neanderthals, while those who remained in Africa gave rise to modern humans. During this period of geographic separation, the lineages were on their way to becoming different species, accumulating genetic differences over many generations, which would have eventually prevented interbreeding. But before that occurred, the groups repeatedly met again and mated during several periods as modern humans spread to Eurasia, beginning about 100,000 years ago. Short and muscular, Neanderthals had bodies adapted to Ice Age Europe. Their craniums were as large as contemporaneous Homo sapiens, and, contrary to the brutish stereotype, Neanderthals made complex weapons, buried their dead, and used a range of resources, from medicinal plants to feathers from birds of prey. They were intelligent, well-adapted, and flexible, says April Noel, a prehistoric archaeologist at Canada's University of Victoria. Yet Neanderthals may have been differently intelligent, proficient at utilitarian tasks, but deficient in social and aesthetic sensibilities. Because Neanderthals rarely made symbolic objects, like beads, some anthropologists argue they were incapable of symbolic thought or language. Others disagree, and note that Neanderthals had many possible adaptations for speech, including sharing a genetic variant with us that's linked to language ability. What's in a name? Knowing that Neanderthals and modern humans interbred, a minority of researchers now prefer subspecies classifications. Homo sapiens neanderthalensis and Homo sapiens sapiens. The names don't change our evolutionary relations. While geographically separated, Neanderthals and modern humans evolved enough differences to be easily distinguished by DNA and physical traits, but not enough to make interbreeding impossible. They were in the process of becoming distinct species, but not quite there. As for pronunciation, King named the first scientifically described specimen for where it was discovered, Neander Valley, or Neanderthal, that being a spelling variation of the word for valley. When Germany standardized spelling in the early 20th century, Thal, T-H-A-L, became Tal, T-A-L. While the formal scientific name remains Homo neanderthalensis, scholars diverge on the colloquial, writing Neanderthal or Neanderthal. But regardless of spelling, both tall and thal have always been pronounced with a soft T in German, similar to the T at the end of thought, rather than a TH at the same word's beginning. Sex with benefits but mostly costs. In 2016, a genetic study of more than 50 Homo sapiens fossils, 7,000 to 45,000 years old, showed the proportion of Neanderthal DNA in our species diminished over time. This pattern suggests that most Neanderthal genes were harmful to modern humans and were weeded from our gene pool. Individuals with those Neanderthal genes were less likely to survive and reproduce. Some Neanderthal DNA persists today, comprising roughly 2% of the genomes of all non-Africans, but it's generally confined to junk regions that do not contain vital genes. However, Neanderthals do contribute a small number of our functioning genes. To understand their effect on living humans, researchers have analyzed tens of thousands of modern genomes to determine whether individuals with Neanderthal genes are more likely to have certain traits. The results show that many Eurasians have Neanderthal genes influencing hair, skin tone, and immune function, which may have helped their African ancestors adapt to the colder, darker conditions of Europe. On the other hand, Neanderthal genes also increase risk for depression, obesity, and autoimmune diseases. But before blaming your ailments on Neanderthals, remember, these are complex traits, influenced by many genes and lifestyle factors. The end of Neanderthals. The youngest conclusively dated Neanderthal fossils and artifacts clock in at around 40,000 years old. Researchers have put forth a range of possible explanations for their demise, including periods of extreme cold, a volcanic supereruption, or competition with a whole rogues gallery of carnivores, from scimitar cats to cave lions, that kept Neanderthal populations small. Other even less likely hypotheses include illnesses similar to mad cow disease spread through cannibalism. However, most scholars believe modern humans played a role. Neanderthals go extinct right at the same time modern humans get there, says Churchill. I don't think it's a coincidence. Although Neanderthals had survived previous encounters with modern humans migrating from Africa, the wave that arrived roughly 45,000 years ago was different. They came armed with stone projectile points that could be shot long distances. Neanderthals, like earlier Homo sapiens, made thicker points, better for thrusting spears used at close range. And Neanderthals may have already been on the brink. For at least 80,000 years before their end, Neanderthals had extremely low genetic diversity, suggesting they were a small population heading toward extinction. Add competition from projectile-wielding modern humans, plus harsh environmental conditions and threats like cave lions, and you have just a whole bunch of factors coming together that over time led to their demise, says Noble. A perfect storm. Everything worth knowing. Teeth. Brace yourself. Our teeth say a lot. They reveal everything from our eating habits to our social habits. So open wide and let's dive in. A mature human has a complete set of 32 teeth. Four types of teeth are nestled into our jaws: molars, premolars, canines, and incisors, plus the optional wisdom teeth. Our array of teeth means we are heterodonts, like most mammals. Homodont animals, by contrast, have the same type of teeth throughout their jaw, making their bite imprint look mostly uniform. Teeth, which grow in tree-like rings, are made of enamel, the hardest substance in the human body. More than 300 types of bacteria live in the mouth, many of which can be found in dental plaque on the surface of the teeth. Teeth don't come with a lifetime guarantee, though. Because humans are a diphodont, we get only 2 successive sets of teeth throughout our life. Other animals get way more. If they're polyphyodont, like sharks, their teeth are replaced continuously. Harbingers of health. That toothy grin you see in the mirror can shed light on some surprising links among oral health, genetics, and overall health. Although there aren't many direct genetic variables that control oral health, specific genes may raise the risk of gum disease and tooth decay. For example, a sweet tooth gene was discovered by scientists in Denmark in 2017. According to Matthew Gillum, associate professor of metabolic genetics at the University of Copenhagen, people with a specific variant form of the FGF21 gene tend to crave and consume more sugar on average than those with the normal form of the gene. It does have some association with more body fat on your hips, says Gillum. It's likely to be the case that individuals with sweet-preferring genes drink more alcohol than average. He thinks it has something to do with the liver protecting itself from too much sugar or alcohol. FGF21 acts as a brake on sugar overindulgence from the liver for self-defense reasons, Gillum says. Teeth that can't function properly will spur a cascade of effects. Left untreated, a decaying or abscessed tooth can lead to potentially life-threatening complications. In 2007, a 12-year-old boy died after bacteria from an abscessed tooth spread to his brain. If a toothache is preventing you from eating normally, it can adversely affect your diet and physical health, while misaligned teeth can cause headaches, sinus problems, facial deformities, and even obstructed breathing. On top of that, oral health is highly correlated with cardiovascular and nervous system health, since the harmful microorganisms on the teeth and gums and in the mouth can easily travel throughout the entire body. Teeth can also act as mirrors to our internal health, giving clues to sometimes hidden disorders. For example, congenital syphilis can interrupt tooth formation. The upshot? Don't put off that trip to the dentist. Bite-size facts. Incisors are front and center, and they are for biting. They're the first baby teeth to emerge. Canines are sharp and used for shredding and ripping apart food. Premolars are more substantial than canines or incisors, and they are used for grinding and chewing food. Molars tend to be flatter and wider than premolars, but their function is the same. Wisdom teeth might have been molar teeth in the days before agriculture, when human jaws were bigger, because raw, wild plants and meat were tougher to break down. Changes in culture and diet caused jaws to shrink, leading to overcrowding and impacted wisdom teeth, which may then grow sideways due to lack of room. On the record, teeth collect a wealth of information throughout a person's lifetime. Our individual dental records are as unique as fingerprints. A bite mark can be as useful in identifying someone as DNA from a tooth. In modern forensics, scientists can predict with high accuracy age at death, sex, ethnicity, habits, and sometimes even occupation using only dental records. Archaeology benefits from tooth tales, too. Scientists can reconstruct microbiomes from the microbes trapped in plaque. These mini-bacterial microcosms can offer clues to ancient lifestyles, behaviors, habits, culture, and even social conventions, such as shared kisses and meals. Bacteria in plaque can also tell us about ancient human seasonal migratory patterns, based on tracking how bacteria changed in genetic structure over time. Teeth can divulge lifetime exposure to metals, toxins and other pollutants. And tooth tails aren't limited to humans. In 2016, an examination of hippo teeth by scientists from the University of Utah and Universitat Braunschweig unearthed data about changes in past environment and climate. A bite of biodiversity. What do toothy smiles look like across the animal kingdom? Some are familiar, others more alien. Teeth in nature come in all shapes and sizes. The spiraling tusk of the narwhal inspired illustrations for the horn of the mythical unicorn. However, this horn is actually an overgrown tooth that projects from the whale's jaw. The narwhal has no teeth inside its mouth, unexpectedly since its diet is mostly fish. Even more surprising, the tooth functions as a sensory organ, with millions of nerve connections running through it. Because the tusk can sense changes in seawater salinity, it can help narwhals navigate through different marine environments. They can also use their tusk like a club to stun prey. The Chinese water deer is the only deer species without antlers. But don't worry, they have a different defense mechanism going for them. The male deer brandish tiny tusks, 2 inches long on average, that protrude from their mouths. The animals are a more primitive form than your average white-tailed deer. Most experts believe that antlers evolved after tusks, although both are used to defend against predators. Sea urchins have teeth made of calcite crystal that are strong enough to chew through rocks. The structure of the crystal matrix in the teeth gives them stability and durability. They continuously grow and self-sharpen. Parrotfish also have impossibly strong teeth, allowing them to chomp on coral and grind it into fine sand. A network of different interwoven biominerals, such as fluorapatite and crystals, mean the teeth are tough and don't wear down. The naked mole rat can maneuver each of its teeth independently, similar to chopsticks. Like most rodents, the mole rat has teeth that are always growing and need to be ground down. The chompers are outside the mouth, keeping them from swallowing dirt as they dig. The teeth can also be used for moving objects, social interactions, such as fighting for dominance, and, of course, feeding. Additionally, a vast portion of the mole rat's brain's somatosensory cortex signals, pain, pressure, temperature, are relayed via the teeth. The fangs of a snake come in 2 forms, both efficient at delivering venom. In grooved fangs, the venom gland runs in an indentation along the fang. In hollow fangs, the venom gland runs inside the fang, as though running through a tube. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover, the magazine of science. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. Till then, expand your mind. I'm Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.